السلام والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه ومن استنى بسنته إلى يوم الدين. All praise due to Allah and Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. Today we will begin the first in a series on Islamic studies covering the topics Tawheed, Tafsir, Hadith and Fiqh in order. And this order has been chosen because we know that the foundation of Islam is Tawheed. This is what determines whether a person is a Muslim or a non-Muslim in terms of stepping into the fold of Islam. And the foundation of Islamic knowledge is the Quran, and Tafsir represents the interpretation, the understanding of the Quran. And that foundation is coupled with another foundation known as the Sunnah, the way of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and that is contained within what we call Hadith. Together, the Quran and the Sunnah, the principles within the Quran and the Sunnah, make up what is known as the Sharia. Sharia. And the application of that divine law, which is referred to as Sharia, according to problems and issues which occur in human life, this is known as fiqh. So this is the order that we'll be following, beginning with Tawheed, followed by the Quran, explanation, understanding, Sunnah, and finally fiqh, the application or the fundamentals for understanding how the Sharia should be applied in daily life. Before going into the concept of Tawheed, the fundamentals of it, I would just like to stress that education is something which, as Muslims, we hold in very high esteem. This is something of great importance, particularly for brothers and sisters who have come out of non-Islamic backgrounds and reverted to Islam, or converted to Islam, or embraced Islam, however you want to put it, and came out of a situation where the educational system was a part of the oppressive leftovers of colonialism. And living in England, that oppressive system with its racism, etc., you know, left many people with a very negative view towards education. So many of our brothers and sisters have come into Islam having dropped out to varying degrees from the educational system which exists in the country here. And I understand, naturally, that when a person accepts Islam, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden they become a new person in all aspects. True, Islam is a turning point, and it is supposed to produce a new individual, the Muslim, who is supposed to be distinctly different from the kafir, the non-Muslim. However, the reality is that when we come into Islam, we usually carry with us much of what went before. So, it is very important for us to realize that Islam has put great stress on education. And education, of course, begins with knowledge of what is necessary from the religion for one to be able to obey the commandments of Allah in all aspects of one's life. I mean, this is the most important aspect of knowledge. However, the other knowledge which is necessary for a Muslim to be able to function, to establish a society, is also necessary knowledge. So, it is very important that we understand that though many of us would like to go to Medina or Mecca, Egypt, Sudan, wherever, to go and study Islamic studies, the vast majority of us will not be able to go. And the vast majority of those who go will not be able to complete their studies. Because, as I have pointed out earlier, that the numbers of those people, the percentage of those people who have gone to study in the universities of Saudi Arabia, Mecca, Medina, and Riyadh, the percentage of those who graduated from their studies is less than 1%. Less than 1%. So, not only is the process of going to study not an easy process, it is something that if the whole community pins all its hopes on going to study in Medina and Mecca, etc., then they will be lacking in many other vital areas which are necessary for building and establishing Islam as a real community here in England. So I would advise and encourage you brothers and sisters to advise those who accept Islam to go back into the educational systems and to complete their education. Utilize the system here has provided many, many access courses and, you know, government-aided programs where a person can go for no cost and complete his education and go on into various fields which are necessary for the building of a community. Because the building of the community is going to require plumbers, carpenters, lawyers, doctors, and all the various fields. And if we are not prepared to make those kind of sacrifices, then we're not really serious about establishing Islam. I mean, Islam is more of a fad. You know, it's something interesting, it's fun for a while, but it's not really taken on as a way of life where we feel that, you know, this is the beginning and the end. There is nothing else. We're not serious, because if we're really serious, then we have to have a scope, a vision, which includes the establishment of Islam as a way of life in this country. Otherwise, according to the scholars of Islam, it is haram for us to be here. If we're not about that, we're just about carrying on day-to-day lives, you know, just to work, get food, anyhow, eat, sleep, you know, like the animals, like the non-Muslims, and that's what we're about, then it is haram for us to be here. This includes those brothers and sisters who have migrated here, for example, come from Bangladesh or come from Pakistan or India or wherever. They've come here. The scholars of Islam are unanimous that it is haram for a Muslim to leave the country of Islam, the land of Islam, and go to the land of Kufr for the dunya, for material gain, just to eat, sleep, drink, have a good time. It is haram. Scholars are unanimous on this. So, for a person to be here, you see, one has to have a justification for being here. That justification has to be the establishment of Islam, conveying the message of Islam to these people who don't know about Islam. If we're about that, if that is our intention, this is what we're striving. This is not just intention in the sense of this is what we say, but this is reflected in our lifestyle, then we are justified in being here. Otherwise, we should not be here. Of course, realistically speaking, we know that to a large degree, the so-called Muslim countries won't open their arms and say, come, right? This is, we have to be realistic, you know. So we don't really have too much choice in terms of hijrah to leave here and go to a Muslim country. Things are not so straightforward. In many Muslim countries, if you call for Islam, call for the establishment of Islam, you're considered to be, you know, some kind of enemy of the state. In Indonesia, 150 million Muslims, it is considered their treason to call for the establishment of the Islamic State. People have been executed there for calling for the establishment of Islamic law. So this is the realities of the Muslim countries. So we understand, practically speaking, we cannot go around now and say to every Muslim who's here, whether he's from Bangladesh or he's a convert, that you have to get out of here. It's haram for you to be here. No. Realize, practically speaking, there is not much choice. You don't have too many places to go, and many people cannot just pick up and leave here. So the reality is we're here. Now we have to justify our stay. In other words, we have to do what it is Allah wishes for us, wants from us here, to make our stay here blessed. Otherwise, our stay will be cursed. And the basis of gaining the blessings of Allah for staying here, being present in this society, is striving to establish Islam on a personal level, on a community level, and to convey the message of Islam to the community in which we are. The other point I'd like to mention just before going into Tawheed is something concerning the naming system of Islam, because of the fact that I've observed that many brothers, on coming into Islam, brothers and sisters, they have their names changed in a fashion which is actually not according to the Islamic system, you know, from Yusuf Islam on down. You see, the system of naming in Islam is based on some principles. The English system of naming used to be based on principles, but in time it has evolved and become just really your last name is the only thing of real importance, which identifies your family. But there was a time when the names indicated genealogy. Genealogy meaning your parents, your foreparents, who they are, etc. This is what the original naming system included. And so you found people used to be called the son of John. Son of John became John's son and eventually became Johnson. But before, in the past, people were called so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. And this is part and parcel of the Islamic naming system. And the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam had commanded us to name ourselves according to our families, our parents' names, our father's names to be specific. When the Prophet Muhammad adopted a freed slave of his by the name of Zayd ibn al-Harith, right? Zayd ibn al-Harith, I meant Zayd, the son of al-Harith. His name was changed to Muhammad, so he became known as Zayd ibn Muhammad, Zayd, the son of Muhammad, until they reached Medina. When they reached Medina, then the verse from Surah Al-Ahzab, verse number 5, was revealed, in which Allah said, call them by their father's names. It is more just to Allah. So the Prophet ﷺ stopped that and returned Zayd's name according to the naming of his father. And the Prophet ﷺ went on to say, in a number of hadith, you know, related to this, which he said, this is found in Sahih Bukhari, etc. This first one I'll mention is found in Sahih Bukhari and Muslim. He who knowingly attributed his fatherhood to someone other than his real father will be excluded from paradise. He who knowingly attributed his fatherhood to someone other than his real father will be excluded from paradise. In another narration, Prophet ﷺ said, he who deliberately lets himself be called the son of someone other than his father is guilty of kufr, of disbelief. This is something serious then. The fact that the Prophet ﷺ will say that one who attributes his fatherhood knowingly to other than his father is not entering paradise. One who allows himself to be called the son of other than his father is in a state of kufr. Then this is saying that the issue of names has a particular place of importance within the Islamic system as a whole. So when we come into Islam, whether as a realization or conversion, then we try to take Islam as a complete whole, as a series of systems dealing with various aspects of our life, whether it's a system of eating, system of prayer, economic systems, etc., and the naming system also. We shouldn't be so insistent about all the other systems, but then when it comes to names, we should, you know, anyhow, anybody do it as you please. No. So what happens is that according to the Arabic naming system, which the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ approved, a person's name, the given name, was followed by the name of his father. So the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ, his name was Muhammad ibn Abdullah, Muhammad the son of Abdullah. So when a person comes into Islam, if he chooses for himself a name, and it is not a requirement for him to change his name. It's not a requirement for a person, because you become a Muslim, that you automatically must change your name. No. Then many of the companions did not change their names. They came and talked to themselves, didn't just come, everybody came and gave them a new name, new name. No. If their names had some particularly negative meanings, ones which were particularly ostentatious, claiming for themselves things which were, you know, not really the right of any individual, or if they had meanings which were connected with kufr, paganism, idolatry, these names were changed. So a person comes into Islam, the way the person would adjust and correct the naming system is that if his name, for example, was Michael Johnson, his father's name is Joseph Johnson, when he comes into Islam, according to the Islamic naming system, his name automatically becomes Michael Ibn Joseph Johnson. He may now change Michael. He doesn't particularly want Michael. He wants to get an Arabic sounding, Islamic sounding name. So he chooses Mikael, maybe, or Mikael, is the Arabic version of Michael. Or he chooses Muhammad. If he chooses Muhammad, his name is Muhammad Ibn, the son of Joseph Johnson. This is what his name is. The Ibn, you can write it in or you can leave it out. If you leave it out, he is Muhammad Joseph Johnson. That is the correct system. When he has a daughter, his daughter's name, if he chooses the name Fatima, for example, His daughter will be Fatima, bint, if you decide to write it in, means daughter of Muhammad Joseph Johnson. I mean, if you give the daughter Fatima, if you give her the name Fatima Aisha Safiya Muhammad, a name like that, what this actually means, you see, when you give a second name after the child's name, this indicates genealogy, as I said. If you don't put the father's name there and you put a female's name there, this usually means that the woman committed fornication. So the child is then attributed to the mother. So Aisha Fatima, for example, means, or Fatima Aisha means Fatima, the daughter of Aisha, who bore her out of wedlock. You see, so this is the system. What you will find, well, of course, it doesn't become so obvious here until you go to the Middle East. When you go to the Middle East and to Arabic Muslim countries, when they will ask you to write your name, they'll ask you to write first, you know, your given name. Then they'll ask for your father's name. Then your grandfather's name. Then the name of your family, the general name of your family. That's how they'll ask you. You know? And of course, you know, for a lot of brothers, when they call it, it's a bit confusing because, you know, that's not how you write your name. In the end, when you put all these names together, that doesn't make up the name that you're going by. You know? But that is how it is supposed to be. That is the correct method of naming. So it is important, you know, for those of us who feel that it is necessary for us to follow the way of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam in this regard, or in all regards, that we, you know, make this correction. Help those who are coming into Islam to realize what is the correct way, and that we correct, you know, our names where it is possible. You know, where it may involve a lot of money, we can't afford it at this point in time, whatever, you know, we ask Allah's forgiveness, we did something in ignorance, we carry on, and if time permits or opportunity permits, we try to adjust it, you know. And this thing is not just for people who just converted into Islam. Commonly in India and in Pakistan, many of these other countries, they've gone away from this system also. Because I'm sure, brother, you're somewhere from Bangladesh, from Pakistan, right? What is your first name? Ishtak. What is your second name? Huh? Eli. Is this your father's name? Yeah. And then what's the name that comes after? You just took these two. But I mean, I know a number of other people who they may have three names, but it doesn't represent that middle name doesn't necessarily represent the father's name. You know, maybe a grandfather. You know, they have different systems. They, you know, the names are not following this pattern that I have identified. You know, so I'm saying it's not just, it is something which has become widespread around the Muslim world, you know, in ignorance. And it's something which, you know, needs to be addressed, especially in our context here, you know. Of course, you will find people, you know, coming into Islam who may not want to keep this other name because, you know, they get into a kind of a nationalist type of thing where they're saying, well, this is really the slave master's name, and you know, from the Malcolm X days, you know, where they put X in the place of the name, and they want to, you know, they say, well, no, but you see, the point is that, one, for the vast majority of us, we don't know how that name actually came about. We know, in reality, that the slave master had relations with the slave. And this is, most of us who are various mixtures are products of those relationships. So the slave master may very well be the great grandfather, whether you like it or not. You know, I mean, this is the reality, you see. So it's not worth trying to get into arguments and knocking yourself out about, right? The reality is that your father, what was the name that your father went by? If his name was, you know, Joseph Johnson, that's your father's name. That you are the son of Joseph Johnson, regardless of how Johnson came about, you know, generations back. That's not significant. What's significant here is that your name is, you are the son of Joseph Johnson. What is the importance of this? Because the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he told us that we should learn what, you know, of our family trees, what is sufficient to protect the rights of inheritance and to prevent incest, marrying within the prohibited degrees. Because what is the reality here? If you decide you come into Islam, your name was Michael Johnson, and you change your name to Muhammad Kenyatta or whatever, you know, you took some name, you know. Now, your father, he had relations with another woman someplace else. He had a daughter. She comes into Islam. She calls herself Fatima, you know, Fatima Muhammad or whatever. And perchance you meet Fatima Muhammad, you could marry her. And she would be your half-sister. And that is, of course, a major sin. Whereas if you chose, put your name correctly as Muhammad Ibn, you know, Joseph Johnson, and she chose the name Fatima Bint Joseph Johnson, no chance of you marrying your half-sister. So this is where the significance comes, to protect you from falling into marriages which are prohibited, as well as identifying the rights of inheritance. When the time comes to divide up, if you die and you have to divide up inheritance, people want to track down who are your Muslim relatives who we need to give a portion of your money to. By correct genealogies, we'll be able to determine that. Anyway, you know, for further detail on that, the naming system, this can be found in my tafsir of Surah Hujurat in the second edition, pages 112 to 118. You know, I've gone into it in detail, bringing all the verse, hadith, examples of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam changed people's names, etc., etc. Now, on to Tawheed. Tawheed literally means unification, bringing things together into one. And when we use it in relationship to Allah, it does not mean that. Unification, as you said, unification, in context of Allah, we cannot apply that literal meaning of the term Tawheed to Allah, in the sense that we do not consider Allah to be three who is united into one, where we could have this process taking place. But no, what we consider, we use the term Tawheed here, it really means maintaining the unity of Allah in our relationships with Allah. The things that we do, which are various aspects of worship that we do for the sake of Allah. Our concept of the world around us, of people, within, when we look at the world, when we look at our existence, we look at it within the context of the unity of Allah, that Allah is one. And for the purpose of analysis of this concept of Tawheed, and I should mention that when the Prophet Muhammad sent Mu'adh ibn Jabal to Yemen, as the governor of Yemen, he told him that you will be coming to a people who are from the people of the book. And the first thing that you should call them to is the oneness of Allah. So this is where da'wah starts from. This is the foundation. And he said, if they accept that, then tell them about Salah. You go on stage by stage. So it means that even when we look in terms of da'wah, when we're trying to convey the message of Islam to non-Muslims, then it's very essential for us to get to this point. Of course, it may be difficult. You may not be able to start from that point in conversation, because most people, if you start to talk, guess what? Allah is one. I mean, they don't want to listen. They don't want to talk about religion or whatever. So you may start a conversation with something else, you know, something else which is attractive to them, which is interesting to them, whatever. But what you try to do is to steer that conversation to that point of realization of the oneness of Allah and man's relationship to Allah. So, for the purpose of analyzing this concept, scholars have divided the field of Tawheed into three aspects. Tawheed al-Rububiyyah, literally meaning maintaining the unity of Lordship. Tawheed al-Asma wa-Sifat, maintaining the unity of Allah's names and attributes. And Tawheed al-Ibadah, maintaining the unity of worship. Now, the scholars made this breakdown of Tawheed for the purpose of presenting a logical and systematical rebuttal for those people who had begun to deviate from the correct concept of Tawheed in Islam. I mean, you won't find this breakdown amongst the Sahaba, because in the time of the Sahaba, there was very little deviation in terms of concepts. Towards the end of the time of the Khulafa al-Rashidun, the righteous caliph, these deviations started to become, to enter into the body of Muslims. As Islam spread into Syria and into India, into Egypt, etc., people who accepted Islam, some of them brought in with them some of the previous concepts which they have as Christians or as Zoroastrians or as Hindus or whatever. They brought these things in with them. You know, some people, many people brought it in with, you know, as they grew in Islam, these were removed. Other people who were, you know, very philosophical in their approaches, you know, they sometimes wanted to maintain these concepts and to give them an Islamic cloak, felt they were still valid, and to try to put them in Islamic terms. And they tried to express these. When they tried to express these, the early caliphs used to, you know, where people complained against these people were banished or they were executed or whatever. They wouldn't allow this to take place. However, you know, as the Umayyad state dynasty became more and more corrupt, then the concern of the caliph of maintaining purity of ideology was not so great, and so you found more and more people who would arise and make statements concerning Allah and concerning man, etc., which were deviant. And it then became the duty of the scholars of that time to refute these ideas, to defeat them, you know, using the Quran and Sunnah in a logical and acceptable fashion which would convince the masses of the people. And it is out of that process, that effort to combat these deviant ideas, that the science of Tawheed arose. And the scholars broke the system down into various groupings. This breaking it down into three is just one possible breakdown. Some people break it into two, some may break it into four. You know, I mean, the numbers are not critical. We don't think that this breakdown is the only possible breakdown. This is just one breakdown which was used by a number of scholars. The first category, which I referred to as Tawheed al-Rububiyyah, or the unity of Lordship, this refers to the acceptance of Allah as being the only source of power in the universe. When you say la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah, there is no movement nor power except by Allah's will. We are affirming this. The term Rabb, from which Rububiyyah comes, literally means Lord, the creator, the sustainer, the one who looks after, رب العالمين. And what this refers to when we talk about Tawheed or Rububiyyah is that whatever happens, whatever takes place in the life of a man, this is by the wish and the will of Allah. That is, we don't attribute it to anything other than Allah. When we talk about qada and qadr, the destiny, this is an expression of this aspect of rububiyyah. Whatever takes place is as Allah will. Allah will. This means then that good fortune and misfortune are according to the destiny of Allah. We don't attribute good fortune and misfortune to anything other than Allah. When we do so, we commit shirk in this aspect of Tawheed. And this is something, you know, very widespread in our Western society, wherein people talk about lucky numbers, lucky this and lucky that, bad luck in this way and that way and the other way, you know. In England it may vary to some degree from, you know, what I know in America, but most of the things are quite similar. I know in America, for example, you know, you would be hard pressed to find an apartment building which has a 13th floor. You know, you go up, the elevator will say 12, 14, 11, 12, 14, 15. I mean, what it is that 14 is already 13, but they renamed it 14. When you go down the street, you're hard pressed to find a house whose number is 13 on the block. It'll go 12, 12, 8, 14, but you won't find 13. Hard pressed to find it. And.
God, yes, you for half an hour.
Sure. What the reason for this may be, not necessarily that everybody who does this believes that 13 is a bad luck number. Some people, like, you may approach an apartment owner of an apartment building, ask him, why you don't have 13 floor? He'll tell you, you know, because if I had a 13 floor, nobody would rent on it. So just practically speaking, you know, he's dealing with economics. If he has a floor number 13, he found nobody renting on it, so he called it 14 people renting. So on the basis of that, he goes with 14, you know. But in fact, this concept is really deeply embedded into the society to such a degree that I remember reading in the newspaper, newspaper interviewers, you know, there was an Apollo shot, moon shot, back in the 60s, late 60s, that had gone off for the moon, but something had gone wrong with the steering mechanism and it looked like they were going to miss the moon. They're going to go flying off into space. And for the Americans, this was a big tragedy. For the Russians, they had people going off into space all the time. It didn't matter, you know. Russian people are expendable. So they would try all kinds of things, send people off into space and be crying, help us, you know. That's it. Whereas for Americans, for one person to die in a space mission is a big, you know, embarrassment. So the whole American society is very upset and worried and so on. In any case, they managed to fiddle around and use they had a lunar lander. They used a retro rocket from it to change the course of the ship so it was able to catch the gravitational pull of the moon and come back to the Earth. They had to abort the mission. They couldn't go to try and land on the moon. They just came back to Earth, splashed down. So after they picked up the people out of the ocean, brought them to Cape Canaveral, they got off the plane, they're walking down, he reported, ran up to the captain who was the head of the mission, asking, you know, how do you feel? So, you know, they're waiting for his first impression. He said, I should have known it was going to happen. I should have known. He said, how should you have known? He said, because this was Apollo 13. This now is a man who's got a PhD in, you know, astrophysics, and, you know, he's telling them that he should have known because it was Apollo 13. It took off at 1300 hours. That's 1 o'clock. On Friday the 13th.
All those 13 coming together, man, that was like a doomed mission, you know, as far as he was concerned. But this is just showing you how deeply rooted these concepts of shirk are, you know, are embedded in the society. And it is important for a Muslim that he or she, when they come into Islam, root these things out. Because for sure, when we come into Islam, it doesn't mean automatically whatever you believed before of these omens and such is automatically gone. You may still find yourself crossing your finger, knocking on wood, and you know, these kind of things. Just, you know, inadvertently you're still doing these things. So it is very important that the Muslim go back into their practices, etc., and clean this up. Put one's trust on Allah alone, knowing that one's destiny is by Allah. Whatever happens in life, good or evil. The second major area of Tawheed is known as Tawheed al-Asma wa Sifat. Unity, or maintaining the unity of Allah's names and attributes. And I should mention before going into that, that in Tawheed al-Rububiyyah, this Tawheed is also destroyed by the practice of amulets, the use of amulets. Now, this is another area now which maybe for convert Muslims is not much of an issue, but for Muslims coming from various parts of the Muslim world, you know, the use of amulets is very common. People have what they call ta'weez and different things that they will tie around their arms, around the necks, around the waist of the babies, this type of thing they believe will protect them from misfortune. And people have even taken the Quran and turned it into a charm. In that, people will write the Quran on, you know, on posters, they'll put it on the walls, or on jewelry, and they wear it around their necks, believing that by putting this verse from the Quran on your wall, or by wearing it on your neck, it's going to protect you from evil. When a person does that, they're using the Quran like a charm, an amulet, something which is prohibited. And said, whoever, you know, has worn a charm, you know, a tongue of charm around their neck, they're committing shirk. And you'll find, I remember reading about, you know, in, I think it was in Bahrain, some person there, they bought this Quran, which is only 2.25 inches by, you know, 3.25 inches. And they said, this is the smallest Quran in the world. And the moment somebody in India came, no, we have one here which is 1.75 inches by, you know, 1.5 inches. You know. And you see these Qurans. These Qurans are written in letters so small you cannot see it with a naked eye. You have to use a microscope to read it. So you know the intention of the person who is doing this Quran, who is using this Quran, is not nothing but using it as an amulet. These are ended up put inside of lockets. People wear these lockets around their necks, and they believe it's going to protect them from Allah, from evil. And this is, in fact, a form of shirk. People may do this with zikr beads, for example. You know, you see, people will have zikr beads, and after, you know, making zikr or whatever, you know, they rub the beads, they blow on them, they do all kinds of things. They carry these beads, they hang it in their cars, they you know, they believe these zikr beads now because of having done zikr with these beads, you know, somehow it has special barakah and power which will protect them from evil. This is shirk. Now, Tawheed al-Asma wa Sifat, you could say, basically means maintaining Allah's unity with regards to His names and His attributes in such a way that we only refer to Allah according to the way in which He and His Messenger have referred to Him. We don't make up any attributes to describe Allah. Similarly, if Allah has described Himself in a particular way, He or His Messenger, we don't try to reinterpret it in such a way as not to mean what it obviously States.
We don't play around with the names. Allah calls himself, this is what we refer to Allah by.
It also means that we don't give Allah's names and attributes